Moncrief on News Talk.
Now, you may have seen stories in the media today about the TV gardener Alan Titchmarsh. Apparently, they screen some of his shows in North Korea, but they blur out his genes. Explanations for this range from the genes being a symbol of Western imperialism to genes effectively being banned there. But is the truth about this a little more nuanced? Joining me now is Professor Hazel Smith from the School of Oriental and African Studies at University of London and author of North Korea, Markets and Military Rule. Hazel, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks for inviting me on your show.
Now, you did live in North Korea for a couple of years. So when you took out your jeans, were you wrestled to the ground by armed guards or anything?
Listen, every foreigner, and I'm talking about there were a lot of foreigners in North Korea, if you include all the Russians and the Chinese and all the international officers that were there when I was there, which was about 20 years ago, although I've been other times as well, everybody wore jeans, because they're the most comfortable and most practical thing you can wear in a country where it's quite cold, where you've often got to wear long johns underneath in the winter especially, and nobody bats an eyelid. What's true is that the North Koreans don't tend to wear jeans, and that's because you can't buy them in North Korea, and they're not imported. And they're certainly not imported now because of sanctions. They prohibit almost anything going into North Korea. So no, it's not true to say that there's the jeans police in North Korea. It is obviously an authoritarian government. And when they do have a campaign against things, you know about it. They're not very subtle. And they never had, in my experience, a campaign against jeans. And I've never seen any documentation which highlights that. So I think this is a bit of an exaggeration from some apparatchik involved in North Korea's TV, who's looked at these trousers for whatever reason and said, oh, I don't know, I'm going to blur that. But I can tell you that it's not a representation of a virulent anti-jeans policy in North Korea.
Yeah, and one would imagine as well, in North Korea, there's been famines in North Korea. I mean, apart from outside Pyongyang, most people are extremely poor. They have better things to be spending their money on than jeans.
Yeah, and that's a really important point. In the 90s, there was a famine. That's why I first went there with the UN for a couple of years, although as an academic, I was seconded in. And even today, well, especially today, since they recovered a bit in the 2000s, and then from 2016, there's been very, very extensive UN sanctions on all their exports and quite a substantial amount of imports. And that's hit agriculture in particular. And North Koreans get most of their food from local agriculture. So what we've seen is the resurgence of starvation. It's a very poor country. The UN puts it on its, of 260 odd countries and territories in the world, North Korea is on the poorest in terms of GDP per capita of the bottom 25, something extreme like that. And agriculture is still in a really bad state. So unless you're well off or part of the elites in North Korea, so that you can import your own food, you're going to be facing, and people are facing, starvation again, and have been for the last 4 or 5 years.
Mm. On the subject of sanctions, I was rather surprised that the BBC are selling them programmes, or are these pirated programmes?
Well, I looked at one of these online newspapers that had put out this story, and once I looked into the detail, because I was a bit puzzled about this, it looks like they've got some historic programmes, one or two, which I don't know whether they've got on licence from the BBC or whether they've just pirated. But in the 2000s, when there was engagement between North Korea and Europe, including the UK, you know, we've got an embassy, the UK has got an embassy in the DPRK in North Korea. There hasn't been anybody actually in there because of COVID over the past few years, but we've still got an ambassador and they're hoping to go back this year. During that period, we saw lots of interaction, and the BBC set up a training program for some of North Korea's journalists. The idea was to open up to new ideas. So we had North Korean journalists in Britain, different parts of Britain, and some of the BBC people went outside there. So it's not beyond the bounds of possibility that the BBC would have at that time let them have a few programmes to show on their TV. And North Korea does show foreign, most of North Korean TV, as you can imagine, is really boring and propaganda. And most people don't believe a word of the propaganda because they know that it contrasts so deeply with everything around them on a day-to-day basis. So like in a lot of the old socialist countries, you know, most ordinary North Koreans would take what they see on the TV with a big pinch of salt. But they do have occasional programs from other countries like Russia, and it will tend to be the European side of Russia that programs come from. Young people in North Korea, although it's a very, very poor country, it's a very highly educated youth. They go to school, all boys and all girls, from the age of about 4 or 5 till 17. And there's a concentration on maths and tech, as there was in all the old socialist countries, nothing new. So they're pretty proficient, technology savvy generation. So many of them have access to USBs, and when they can get a computer, they'll tend to watch South Korean dramas or K-pop. I'm sure lots of young people listening to this show in Ireland know exactly what K-pop is, and Blackpink and all the rest of it, as they are in the UK. They're hugely popular. And so they see within those videos, of course, they're glamorous and stylized. They still see a different life than their own. And that's something that the North Korean government does crack down on. It really does try to crack down on young people seeing South Korean media, because that's where they get an idea that life could be different. But the genes issue, I think, is a bit of a non-story, to be honest.
Yeah, I suppose, though, excuse me, it's kind of slightly born out of, there is a dearth of information, really, about North Korea. And so that void is filled with speculation. I think, Kim is on death's door every other week, you know, if you believe the media in the West.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you do see lots of pictures of him. I saw his father live when I was living in Pyongyang, DPRK. I haven't seen Kim Jong-un, but I mean, you don't have to be a doctor really to see that the size of him. That his health is threatened, and he smokes like a chimney. So he is going to be prone to some form of illness. I think that's pretty obvious. He did lose weight during the COVID period, and that's not surprising because every doctor throughout the world was telling people that would listen to them that if you're overweight or obese, that was made you more at risk during COVID. But he's piled it all back on, so he's clearly vulnerable to some cardiac incident. But other than that, we don't know for sure about his health. Only what we can see on the various North Korean footages when they put something out.
I I've read speculation that that perhaps his daughter, because there's lots of speculation about who might take over for him in that kind of scenario, but that perhaps his daughter might be a candidate, and she's quite young.
Well, again, it's an 11-year-old. And I think if any of your listeners will say, "Oh, my 11-year-old, they're going to be, you know, doing this, that, or the other in 5 or 6 years' time," you know, nobody knows. Actually, South Korean intelligence, which has the most information on North Korea, hard information, I'm not talking about speculation, doesn't know. I mean, I haven't got privileged insight into South Korean intelligence or any other intelligence, but I know from talking to people around this area that they don't have any intelligence on this. And also, we don't even know for sure how many children the current leader has. The sort of an informed view is that he's got an older boy who's not been made public. But, you know, again, we shouldn't read too much into this. Clearly, it's a favourite child. He wouldn't be having her on show if she wasn't. It's not unusual for families to have favourite children. If you look at the Kim's father and grandfather, they didn't decide till pretty much the last minute as to who was going to be their successor of the family. And so it's by no means a done deal that anybody, especially at this age, especially, it doesn't matter if she's a girl, actually, because, you know, some people have said, "Oh, well, it can't happen because she's a girl." That's not relevant. You've got some very senior, important women. The foreign minister in North Korea is a woman. So that wouldn't rule her out. It's just she's too young and we don't know enough rest of the family. And when I say no, I mean have knowledge rather than speculate.
Yeah. Is there any possibility at all that the Kim dynasty might come to an end at some point?
Well, that's the big question. It was before the end of the Cold War, nobody thought that the Soviet Union would become capitalist.
Yeah.
And it happened really, really quickly. what you can say is, it analytically, you know, rather than just speculatively, is that it is a very fragile society and that it's very poor. You've got a lot of young people who are pretty much aware that they could be leading some form of alternative life, at least have other opportunities, not just through what they see in South Korean media, but through China, because Chinese traders come in and out, and China, compared to North Korea, is much, much more developed. And so they will have information from Chinese traders. So there is the conditions are in place for the dissatisfaction that there undoubtedly is with the government. It doesn't deliver on food, doesn't deliver on opportunities. Life's really, really tough. You know, it's hard to have running water. These new buildings that you often see on TV in Pyongyang, they put them up with cement and concrete that isn't of any decent quality because they haven't got the quality assurance or the mechanisms to do that. So these can fall down. These new buildings don't have running water. They don't have toilets that work. So nothing functions in North Korea. It's poor in every single sense. And as I say, you've got this contrasting with these young people in particular that do have the ability, quite a lot of them, to know what's going on outside, who are intellectually developed because the education system, okay, they get information about the Kim family, they have to go through all that. But nevertheless, the education system is otherwise very good. Literate, numerate, is almost 100% numeracy and literacy in a poor country. That's amazing, especially among girls. So you've got this potential dissatisfaction among the population as a whole. It's about 26 million population. But at the moment, there is no way for that to be expressed. There's an opposition political party. Mm. So likely, given what we know about other countries in similar positions in the past, any possible change would come from a part of the ruling elite, maybe one of the other important families, because the Kim family is the most important ruling family. But there are others, and they all intermarry. You've got these complicated interrelationships among these ruling families. But if an alternative ruling family got the power, that would be a route which we've seen in other countries, which could overthrow the Kim family and maybe change direction because it would be beneficial to them to do so, to have trade with the outside world, to have better relations to the outside world. So you can't predict. You know, I say to my students when we're talking about the future of North Korea, you know, we're not Madame Rose, we're not clairvoyants, yes, right? But we can say that the conditions are in place where we shouldn't be too surprised if there was a movement within the North Korean ruling elite to shift the ruling family or to promote somebody in the ruling family that's married into one of the other families so that they would have more power. But that becomes speculative. All we can say is that it's not a happy place to live for anybody, yeah, either from the majority of the poor people or even from the ruling elites who are always coming to risk being sent off to a prison camp if they show some sign of disaffection with the leader. So they're at risk all the time. So it's not a happy country. It's not stable in that sense politically. It's held together by a tight security apparatus. But what happened in the 1990s with the security apparatus, which is so big, people in it were also suffering from hunger. And so that is a disaffection, potential disaffection from within the state apparatus. And then that becomes a problem for a leadership if you can't pay people properly, if you can't make sure they have enough food, if you're sending their children off to military service as they do, especially the young boys, for 7 years and they can never come back from home, and then they're malnourished when they're in the army. You know, none of these things mean that this is a government that can get buy-in from the population. And even in a non-democratic country, you have to, and authoritarian governments try to do it, try to get a level of buy-in, consensus that, you know, this is a government that can give you something. Well, in North Korea's case, they can't give them anything.
Yeah. Professor Hazen Smith from the School of Oriental and African Studies at University of London and author of North Korea, Markets and Military Rule. Thank you very much.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 p.m. on News Talk.